This is Ruth Newman of Election Connection on WFMP 106.5 FM. And I am delighted to have today on the show our newly elected state senator from the 19th District, Senator Cassie Chambers Armstrong, just won a special election to fill Morgan McGarvey's seat. And you hold a graduate degree in public health, public management from the Yale School of Public Health, a law degree from Harvard Law School, and you received a Young Lawyer Award for service to the community in 2018 and began your law career working for the Louisville Legal Aid Society, helping domestic violence survivors. So that's quite a track record already at your young age.
Thank you.
You are also the author of a memoir, Hill Women, Finding Family and a Way Forward in the Appalachian Mountains. So I'd like to welcome you, Senator Armstrong, to my show.
Thank you so much for having me. I am happy to be here. I'm still getting used to being referred to as Senator. It is brand new still.
Yes, I can imagine. I'm just curious to know what you've been going through in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, so it has been a whirlwind. First off, please call me Cassie. I appreciate the Senator Armstrong, but always just Cassie, and I'm so happy to be here and to chat with you. You know, a special election is a whirlwind to start. So Morgan McGarvey announced his intention to resign following his election to Congress, and things moved very quickly from there. It was the governor calling a special election, the parties nominating folks. All of this was happening around the holidays. So it was, you know, coming back in the new year and rushing to file the paperwork and then having a really busy 6 weeks to run a campaign and talk to voters and make sure folks understand that they needed to vote and what the candidates were running on and that this was an important election. And then it has not slowed down since then. It has, in fact, only sped up. And so I just finished my first week in the Kentucky State Senate. Everyone has been so kind and so welcoming and so helpful as I've tried to learn new processes, figure out my parking space and where my office is. And it's just been a really wonderful experience so far.
And have you met any other state senators?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to fully participate in Senate life over the past couple of days. And so that has included meeting senators from both political parties. Obviously, I knew most of the ones from my own party, and they had been kind enough as I was running in the special election, you know, knowing that if I won that election, I'd be dropped right into the middle of session to stay in touch and communicate about what was happening in the session and what was coming and what might cross my desk as soon as I arrived there. And so they were so kind around that. And then I've been welcomed by senators of the other party as well. There was a little reception after I officially got sworn in. And, you know, senators, Democrats and Republicans all stopped by to congratulate me and wish me well. And I have just been really moved by the hospitality. It's been really, really nice.
That's great. Now you represent the 19th district, and that, tell me what is the 19th district? Where is that?
Yeah, so it is, I like to call it the backwards C district. It kind of starts in the Highlands, goes up into St. Matthews a little bit. We get Hikes Point. It comes down around 264, actually extends all the way down to 265 in Outer Loop. So I always say it's from the Highlands to Highview. Covers a lot of ground, has a lot of diversity of opinion. It's a really great district to represent. I've enjoyed getting to know it more during the campaign. So I've represented a good part of it on Metro Council for the past couple of years, and pretty familiar with those areas. And so I made a point in the campaign to get out and knock those areas that I was less familiar with, and really grateful for the hospitality that I received from folks during that.
That's great. That's great. And that gives you a really good introduction now, you know, because I'm thinking you come from a rural area. You grew up in eastern Kentucky. Is that right? In the Appalachians?
Yeah. So I spent most of my childhood in Berea, Kentucky, in Madison County, right there on the edge of Appalachia, right in the foothills. My family is from Owsley County, Kentucky, and so spent a lot of my childhood there as well, which is sort of even further to the east.
So I'm just wondering about if you could talk a little bit from your book about some of the values that you grew up with that were a rural kind of an outlook, the culture, the values that were different from where you are now.
Yeah, so when I wrote Hill Women, one of the things that I wanted to do was share what is good and what is valuable about rural communities, because we know that there are so many rural communities in Kentucky that struggle. And sometimes what we highlight or what we know, especially if those aren't areas that we have a lot of chance to gain familiarity with, is people highlight the struggle, people highlight the poverty, people highlight the challenges. And I think sometimes that can cause people to think that that is all that exists there, and to define success as people leaving those communities. They say, why would anyone go back to those places? Anyone who has the opportunity is going to want to leave. And I used to have friends all the time who would ask me, why don't people in rural communities just move to the urban areas, right? It seems like there are more things there. There are more opportunities. Why would people stay in these communities? And in my experience in growing up in a smaller town, having family and getting to spend a lot of time in like very rural areas of Kentucky and communities that struggle a lot, Owsley County by household income at one time was one of the poorest areas in all of America, the second poorest county by household income, according to the census. And what I tell folks is there is a real sense of community. There is a real sense of connectedness. There is a valuable way of life. There are hardworking, creative, gritty folks in these communities. And there's value to that. There is value to feeling connected to land and to each other and to history and longevity of being a part of something. And so I think so often we write off that. We write off those things that matter so much to folks that live in these rural communities, things like family and connectedness. And I wanted to make sure to show people why those things matter and why we shouldn't write off our rural communities so quickly.
Yeah, and that was really evident in the floods of 2022 with I just heard on PBS about how much of the lifeline there was neighbors helping neighbors to pull themselves out of the flood and rescue people from drowning. And not being asked, but just all of them chipping in and helping when they could, and endangering their own lives.
Yeah,
Yeah, go
in
ahead.
these areas where so often the outside world has not provided the infrastructure to take care of these communities. So often they don't have the resources, they don't have the support, they don't have the funding from whatever center of power you might want to talk about. And so I think it's really important in those communities then that they take care of each other. And it has been a gap-filling measure. It's been something because we have not given them the resources they need. And historically, these are communities, they're harder to get to. Sometimes they're isolated from the rest of the state, the rest of the world. A lot of times they just don't get what they need. And so people have learned to take care of each other, which is great. And it speaks to the good-heartedness of folks there. I think it's also important that we make sure they have those resources they need to see that other communities invest in them, other communities care about them.
Yeah, and that gets into some of the bills that are not being or are being offered in the Senate and in the House as far as lowering the income tax rate, which means that there'll be less money available for infrastructure and resources for these communities. What do you think about that? I mean, the personal income tax is going from 5 to 4.5, and then they say it's going to be reduced more next year to 4%.
Yeah, so I would have voted against that bill if I had been in the Senate when it came before us. I was not. I think there are a lot of ways that we can provide relief to our working families beyond just the income tax, and there are a lot of ways that are a better way to get to that same solution. I really like reducing sales taxes. I think that that's a way to make sure that we're not being regressive in our tax policy while still making sure that we're providing that relief to working families that are struggling. I got one of my first bill requests in, and I'm working on a bill to reduce the sales tax, waive the sales tax actually on diapers, because we know that there are so many essential items that we don't tax, we don't collect sales tax on, things like medicines and whatnot. Diapers are essential. It's something that families need to avoid medical needs for their children. And we know that unmet diaper need is huge for Kentucky families. And so, I think that there are a lot of ways that we can provide relief to working families beyond reducing the income tax.
Yeah, and I think if I'm not mistaken, that Kentucky is one of the low-ranking states when it comes to health and welfare of children. And also, children are one of the highest of our uninsured populations when it comes to health insurance. So, we have a lot to work on, and yet it seems as if our representatives are more interested in, LGBTQ issues that really don't affect people's existence and security, especially in rural parts of Kentucky. We have one of the lowest taxes on cigarettes in the state. We have one of the highest smoking rates in the country. So we don't have the healthiest of populations, and we don't have good health insurance for a good number of our population.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in, and I'll talk a
Yeah.
little bit about the anti-LGBTQ legislation that we've seen moving through the House, soon to come to the Senate. I think you hit the nail on the head when you say there are so many issues that impact Kentucky families right now and Kentucky kids. We're at the top when it comes to child abuse, kids that are living outside of the custody of their parents, struggles with people who are struggling with substance use disorder and the impact that has on families and on kids, educational issues to make sure we're investing in our public schools and providing high quality education. These are big things that we could tackle that would help families. I just got done knocking thousands of doors in a campaign. Not once did I have someone say, the biggest issue that's impacting me is someone asking me to use different pronouns, or the biggest issue that's impacting me is someone else trying to provide gender affirming care for their child. Those were not the things that people talked to me about being the struggles that they had. I think when we look at our LGBTQ youth, it just hurts my heart as a mom, quite frankly, when I see the way that these bills are targeting kids and targeting kids to score political points. It is just, it just makes me really sad. And so the message that I have for LGBTQ youth in Kentucky is like, I see you, I stand with you, I support you. I think we need to be saying that more, especially given what we are hearing come out of Frankfurt these days. And so I will make sure to say that every chance I get. And I hope other people do as well. It's so important for our kids to hear right now.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that you will be able to find areas of commonality with your Republican colleagues in some areas where you can find agreement. Do you see any areas where you can find agreement?
Oh, absolutely. Just today, I co-sponsored my first two bills at the invitation of the Republican primary sponsor. And these were around birthing centers and making sure that we have more access to important, crucial services that those provide, around making sure that pregnant people have access to prenatal care, to birthing centers, to postnatal care. And also, I co-sponsored a bill around prenatal mental health. And, I've had colleagues in my short time there who have said, welcome, I'm excited to work with you on X, Y, or Z issue. And then, obviously, today, with the invitation of a primary sponsor to work together on these issues, that's really exciting. I'm really excited to dive in and form those bridges and those connections. In my experience, the issues around our kids in early childhood education and daycare access and universal pre-K, these are things that are beginning to gain momentum and bipartisan support. And I believe that we can get big things done on them. And so I think it's about talking, exchanging ideas, doing the heavy legislative lifting and taking a deep dive and becoming an expert on issues. And so I'm excited to dive right in and hopefully try to make some good changes in these areas.
Along with the Republican-Democrat divide, do you see a rural-urban divide also in terms of issues and what people think? When you say, for example, that Republicans scoring political points with the LGBTQ issues, is that something where it's more of an issue in rural areas or in the counties that they represent? Is that what it is? Or how is it that they are scoring political points on these kinds of issues?
I actually am not sure that the majority of Kentuckians are buying into that legislative agenda. There have been polls from the Fairness Campaign that have showed that a majority of Kentuckians actually do not favor some of these anti-LGBTQ issues. We saw with Amendment 2 that a majority of Kentuckians did not want to vote to sort of permanently ban abortion in the state and let our extremist trigger law that's currently in effect, sort of be the way that it's going to be for forevermore. And so, I believe that Kentuckians, if you get down and you talk to people, we agree on more than we disagree. That's based on my experience of talking to folks in communities where, we might not at first agree on the issue. We might think that we're very far apart. You get there, you sit down, and you start talking, and you realize that you're not as far apart as you think. And so the example I always give is a relative of mine who we were talking about healthcare and health insurance and access to it. And this relative was saying, the Affordable Care Act has not been good for me. I am not for the Affordable Care Act. I wish that, one of these Republican efforts to repeal it would work. And we started talking about it. And obviously, I was a big supporter of the Affordable Care Act and worked on it in different capacities before running for elected office. And she was saying, what's been hard for me is it's too expensive to force me to pay for health insurance. And that's been financially difficult for me. But she said, I wouldn't have minded it if they had just given it to me for free. That's what they should have done. They should have just given me free health insurance. And that, of course, is starting to talk about universal health care and starting to talk about more of a public option type system or a publicly run system. And that opened the door to have a good conversation about markets and health care and health insurance and the problems in the system. And at the end of the day, we ended up agreeing on 99% of things. And so I think so often we get a little nervous around disagreement. We don't like conflict. We don't want to actually do the hard work of asking questions, sitting with someone that maybe our instinct is to bristle a little bit. Oh no, I couldn't possibly find common ground with that person. But it's about, trying to understand why someone thinks the way they think, trying to figure out what areas you can agree on, and trying to respect the challenges and the struggles that people tell you that they're having so that you can come towards more of a consensus.
Yeah, and I think sometimes a lot has just to do with the way you frame your words. I know that they talk about Medicare for everyone as socialism, and suddenly that raises a red flag with a lot of people. But yet, when you get down into the details, everybody is in alignment. Everybody agrees, So I think that we have to start using words that are inclusive rather than exclusive in a lot of these areas.
And I do want to say, going back to the question that you had about is there an urban-rural divide? I think the answer is yes, there is. Of course, there is. A lot of that is because of silos that we have built up ourselves. So, a lot of people in Louisville, when I talk to them, they talk about out in the state, like it's one sort of unified area that's just out there. It's the rest of the state. There are a lot of people that live in that area. There's a lot of diversity of communities. There are a lot of hardworking, kind, creative, good, smart folks. And we don't often find ways to build meaningful, authentic relationships across that divide. So often, people might go to a community in Eastern Kentucky for half a day to volunteer or something like that. And that's good. It's good to go and experience those communities, and it's good to help. That also doesn't mean that you have built an authentic relationship with that community. I think those sorts of relationships are based on entering as equals to a relationship, finding meaningful ways to connect and bond, seeing for yourself not just the challenges, but also the good things about a community, and figuring out together how you work on issues that you both care about. And so I think part of what we all need to work on is finding these authentic ways to build relationships with people in different areas. We are all in this together. We are all one state. And now in Frankfurt, I believe even more so that our futures are inextricably tied together. As goes Louisville, so goes the state. As goes the state, so goes Louisville. And so we have to work together. It's the only way that any of us are going to move forward on anything.
Absolutely, I agree. And the devil is always in the details on how you go about, finding these authentic relationships, putting people together on projects or in relationships that are meaningful to them. I just wonder if you can think of any examples off the top.
So I'm a writer, I'm a lawyer. What those two things have in common is they're about telling stories. And so I believe that telling stories is how we change the world. And I believe that in large part because of my experience seeing that work. So one of the first legislative experiences I ever had was working with now Congressman McGarvey on a law called Jeanette's Law. And Jeanette was a client of mine when I worked at the Legal Aid Society. She was a domestic violence survivor. She came to me because she could not afford an attorney. Her now ex-husband had assaulted her, physically assaulted her, violently assaulted her, and then fled, cleaned out all of their money, and she came to me because she couldn't afford a lawyer. And what I had to tell her as part of representing her in her divorce case was, although her ex-husband was in jail for the assault, that there was a law in Kentucky that said she still had to pay his legal fees if she wanted to get a divorce from him, even though she had me as her free legal counsel because she couldn't afford a lawyer herself. And seeing the way that that re-victimized her led for us deciding to work to change the law together. And we got to work with then Senator, now Congressman McGarvey to make that happen. He was an incredible advocate, ally, empowered her, listened to her, let her voice be the loudest in the room. But what he really did that made that bill pass in a Republican-controlled legislature, both houses, both chambers controlled by Republicans, is he let her tell her story. And she did that. She showed up, she testified before the state Senate, before the state House. She spoke to reporters, news outlets, anyone that wanted to. She told her story. And even though it was a bill sponsored by the minority party, even though we had a Republican governor at the time, it passed pretty close to unanimously because that's how powerful stories can be whenever people tell you how they've been wronged and what you can do to change it. And so that's why when I wrote a book, I tried to tell women's stories. I tried to elevate those voices. That's why as a policymaker, I try to lift up the voices of the most impacted in our community, find the people experiencing the problems, and let them do the talking. And I believe that if we want the law to change, that's how we do the work to make that happen.
Yeah, and I'm also wondering, in your book, you talked a lot about supportive, generous women in your life and how strong they were and how they were so important in your development. And I'm wondering about the lives of men in rural, a lot of rural Eastern Kentucky areas. And when you talk about telling their stories, now this is just me, I'm an urban person, so I don't know if this is true or not. But I would wonder whether men who have been in work situations like in coal mines, who, I owe my soul to the company store, had horrible working conditions, have to suffer with disabilities from their work, whether their stories are in any way related to the stories of Black men who have a history of enslavement and incarceration and exploitation. I just wonder about men telling their stories who are in exploitative situations, the same as women, and that crossing the rural-urban divide, because similar situations where they're being demeaned, they're impoverished, they can't take care of their families, they get sick. Are there any ways for those two demographics to come together, do you think?
So I think what we often do is we try to pit communities that are struggling against each other. So we try to say we only have a few resources to help communities that have been marginalized, that have been exploited, that have been systematically caused problems by the laws we have in place, right? Bad laws, bad systems. And we sort of say, okay, here's the pot of resources and we can only help some people, and we pit communities against each other. And that is not helpful. And that is not how it should be. And so in my experience, there are more commonalities in struggling communities, and there is strength whenever struggling communities come together and recognize that and say, like, you know, I recognize the ways that you have been marginalized and exploited, and can relate to it in this way, and build power through finding shared things to come together around.
Yeah, very good. So I see that as very, very hopeful. I know this is a big generalization question. What do you think is the attitude of a lot of rural people towards city people? Are there biases? I know there's biases in one direction. I imagine there's biases in the other direction too. Is there some way you could generalize how rural people think of city people?
Yeah, I think a lot, the experiences of people who live in rural areas are vastly different, right? In terms of, you have a lot of people that lived in big cities, and I know someone who lived in New York City and decided to move to Elizabethtown, Kentucky. I know people that went and lived in big city hubs and decided to move back home to Owsley County for one reason or another. And so it is not that everyone who lives in a rural area dislikes urban areas or doesn't have experience with them. So I think it's important that we recognize the diversity in terms of people's experiences in those communities and also their thoughts in those communities. I do think that oftentimes there are some people that in rural Kentucky who believe that folks in urban areas of Kentucky don't understand them and look down on them and judge them and aren't interested in getting to know them. And I think that that's largely what happens in the other direction too. I think there's a lot of, well, they don't understand me. And I think this just goes back to forming those connections and building those authentic relationships, because ignorance is sort of the root of misunderstanding. And whenever you can really get to know people, really see with your own eyes what their communities are about, what they care about, I think that that is when we start to move forward.
If you just tuned in, I'm Ruth Newman, and we have with us today on Election Connection, Cassie Chambers Armstrong, our newly elected state senator, whose roots are in rural eastern Kentucky, but who lives in and represents the 19th District of Louisville. So let's continue on with the conversation. There are a lot of bills right now coming up through the House and the Senate. I mean, besides the LGBTQ, I was looking and I see that there's a bill. You cannot approve of retiring a coal-fired power plant unless it is demonstrated that there will be no negative impact on the affordability rate. You know?
Yeah. That was one that came up on my first day in the Senate, actually. So I will tell you, I'm still new. I'm still getting up to speed. And so there are hundreds of bills. So I'm glad you asked me about one that has been before me as a senator. Those are the ones, of course, I know the big ones. I know that one, but still getting up to speed on some of the smaller ones. But yeah, that's a bill that creates a rebuttable presumption against retiring a coal-fired power plant, and basically says you can't do it if it's going to raise rates or if it's going to impact reliability of the electrical grid. What you heard a lot of the Democrats say about that is a couple of things. One, it's not good policy for us to start putting our thumb on the scale in terms of energy source. We know that a lot of folks are moving to renewable energy. There are a lot of other ways to provide energy other than through our coal-fired power plants. And for government to tie the hands of the Public Service Commission by saying, here is what you have to do, here are the things you have to consider, we're going to micromanage this process. This is the organization that has been entrusted to make these decisions because they have the qualifications to do that. There was a lot of concern about us putting our thumb on the scale and, quite frankly, making it more difficult for us to utilize renewable energy sources into the future. And so you saw a lot of folks on the Democratic side of the aisle standing up and talking about that. The other thing that came up in our conversations is it basically says that you can't retire a coal-fired power plant if it would cause rates to increase. And we know that sometimes as we move to renewable energy sources, that does lead to a short-term increase in rates that then goes down and levels out. And so overcoming that presumption is going to be really difficult whenever folks are trying to transition to renewable energy sources.
Right. And of course, they don't take into account all of the external factors like the destruction to the environment, what coal has done to the health of people who live around coal and work in coal, the fact that so many trees were destroyed in order to establish mines, that was what contributed to all the flooding in eastern Kentucky because there were no trees, to stop the flooding. So, I mean, there are so many external costs that don't get incorporated into these figures when they talk about, affordability.
Yeah, that's one of the big issues in general, right? Is so often we have these systems that let folks create costs to communities, risk to communities, and we don't actually have systems that internalize those costs. And so the more that we can move towards that, it just makes good economic sense to make folks pay the actual rate of the activities that they're engaging in.
Well, maybe I should just ask you what some of your priorities are going into the Senate.
Yeah, I love that question. That's
It's not even one of my questions, but yeah.
yeah, no, thank you for that one. There are a few areas that I would really like to try to work over the next several years to move the needle on. One is early childhood education. I believe that it is something that is gathering bipartisan support. I have a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. The 3-year-old came with me to my swearing in, even though it adds stress and chaos. I think it's important for people to see, particularly women, mothering in public and understand that you can do both things. We don't have enough women in elected office with young children. And my lived experience as a mom of 2 very young kids impacts the fact that early childhood education is a priority of mine. I remember calling around to daycares even before the pandemic hit and we lost another 10% of our childcare capacity and saying, I think I was 4 or 5 months pregnant at the time, and I said, I would like to get a spot at your daycare, please. And they said, okay, great, we'll add you to the waiting list. It's about 2 years. And I remember thinking, I have to go back to work in, 16 weeks after I have this child, and how is this going to work? And like so many families, I eventually cobbled together a system of a few days here, some relatives there, making sort of this patchwork that the second that something falls through, your entire home life, it erupts into chaos, right? Who's going to miss work? Who's going to stay home? How are you going to juggle? And we know that for so many people, whenever that happens, that's why we see so many women leaving the workforce, because women still are the ones that primarily do a lot of that care. That's why we see a lot of folks who lose jobs over childcare issues. They end up getting fired because they don't have access to good childcare. And so I think of early childhood education as something that is both a childcare solution. It impacts those working families, it helps those working families. And we also know it helps kids. So this was one of the issues I worked so hard on Metro Council to get investments in early childhood education, because the research shows us when you provide kids with access to high quality pre-K experiences, those same kids are more likely to graduate down the road. They are more likely to earn higher wages. They are less likely to be justice involved. So it is just this incredible intervention that has this holistic impact on kids that has real staying power.
Right. It's
And
proactive.
so it's proactive, and it's a disruptor of poverty, and it is such an important thing that we can provide. Also, healthcare always a priority. I have a public health degree, making sure that Kentuckians have access to high quality, affordable healthcare. And finally, I talk about this in terms of making sure we have an economy that works for working families. But so often, we are experiencing a great economic boom in Kentucky, and it is wonderful to see. And I think our governor is doing a great job of making sure that as we have this economic explosion, that it is helping people in every income bracket. But I want to do my part to be a part of that to make sure that our economy works for working families and provides them with the things they need, and with livable wages, and with good paying jobs, and with all the supports that they need to be able to thrive. So, a lot of big issues to tackle, a lot of good work to get done, but really excited to work on these things.
And it does indeed start with children. I mean, if they get a good grounding as they're growing up, then they're more likely to be productive contributors to the state. And at the moment, I think we have a very low level in this state compared to other states of high school graduates. I think we have a high percentage of people who do not graduate from high school. And then that just leads to problems down the line. So I'm glad that is one of your priorities.
Yeah, it's a little bit of my lived experience as well. So, my parents brought me home from the hospital to a rented trailer. They were college students at the time I was born. We struggled. They struggled when I was a child. And yet, because of community, because of access to programs that helped with health insurance, that helped with quality food, that provided free childcare so that they could finish their education, high quality childcare, early childhood education for me, that has impacted me for the rest of my life. I've seen how that created the opportunity. So often I like to talk about my journey from, Eastern Kentucky, coming home from the hospital to that trailer, to going to Harvard and Yale and the London School of Economics, is not a journey that's about me, but a journey that's about community and government and family and all of us. And it takes all of that to create opportunities for folks. And so often we want to try to reduce it to some sort of singular thing that someone did. We want to make it about the person that experienced the change. And it's not that that's not the right way to talk about it. It's too easy of a way to talk about it. And so what we need to be focused on instead is the complex stories around the systems and the policy interventions and all the different factors that it takes to create opportunity. We are recording this on the day that the storms are rolling through, and I, like a lot of other families with young kids, have both of my children at home, and so it has cut down on my time today. So I appreciate you having me here today to talk about all of those things, and I've enjoyed our conversation.
And I guess that means you have to go.
I do. Got childcare issues of my own, but appreciate you having me on.
Well, thank you. That was Senator Cassie Armstrong, who has hit the ground running in our Kentucky State Senate chambers after winning a special election to fill now U.S. Congressman Morgan McGarvey's seat in the state Senate. And Senator Armstrong will be making a special appearance at Forward Radio's six-year anniversary party being held Saturday, April the 8th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the CORE, K-O-R-E, Gallery, 942 East Kentucky Street. So mark that in your calendars. There'll be plenty of food, live music, dance, and other fun stuff. And you'll probably be hearing more about this as we gear up for our annual pledge drive starting March the 27th. So in the several minutes that we have left, I'd like to talk a little about our recent power outage. And here to help me sort things out is Tim Darst, who teaches classes in sustainability at the Passionist Earth and Spirit Center. He's on the board of Interfaith Power and Light. He also is adjunct professor in the Department of Environmental Studies at Bellarmine University, and he has a master's from Harvard University in sustainability and environmental management. That's a long pedigree. So thank you, Tim, for coming on.
Thank you, Ruth, for having me on.
Now, we just went through what has been called the third most significant weather event in 20 years. And according to the National Weather Service, Louisville experienced wind gusts of between 60 and 80 miles per hour, which downed 3,300 power lines, broke over 700 utility poles, and caused over 395,000 homes to lose their power. I was one of those, and my power was out for 6 days.
Wow.
So, can you come up with any lessons learned from this event?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is this isn't likely an isolated event. We are clearly seeing a change in our climate. So, as scientists predicted decades ago, our storms are going to be stronger and they're simply going to have more power in it because of climate change. So continuing to get our energy from coal and natural gas is just going to make this worse over time. We need to first move away from the fossil fuels. Now, if you're looking for a solution, another possible alternative would be having things like microgrids. A microgrid is, instead of having one large grid where everyone's tied to the power plant, have regional power stations that could be powered by solar and other renewables.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, you know, small communities could be more resilient as climate change impacts us more and more.
Mm-hmm. Could you go in a little into what renewables you're talking about? What would work for Kentucky?
Sure. Mainly for Louisville, for a city like Louisville, it would be rooftop solar. So having solar panels on homes and garages and having them in communities, having people with storage capacity to be able to weather these storms could be an alternative. You're not going to put too many wind turbines in a city, but solar is clearly an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be moving to things like geothermal, to ground source and air source geothermal for heating. Reduces our energy use dramatically. It takes the heat from deep beneath the earth or from the air, and using much less energy can heat and cool our homes. So geothermal, heat pumps, as well as solar and microgrids could be a more resilient future that does not contribute to climate change.
Now, I know recently the bill that was introduced in the state legislature that they want it so that, I think it just went from the, it passed in the House, it went into the state Senate, that LG&E cannot look into alternatives to coal. If there's any possibility for raising rates and it kind of ties their hands. So are you talking about LG&E doing this, or are you talking about individuals or regional communities doing this, funding this?
Sure. Yeah. Let me first talk about the bill that you mentioned.
Yeah.
The utilities were even against that bill because it ties their hands. They want to have the ability to do whatever they want, and they feel like this bill is going to force them to actually raise rates. The lawmakers who were sponsoring the bill were trying to lead us to believe that this would help lower rates, but the utilities have confirmed that this was actually going to cost more. The costs for renewables are going down over time. Mm-hmm. The costs for the fossil fuels are going up over time. Mm-hmm. And so clearly the fossil fuels are going to be more expensive. They already are. They're about parity now. So mm-hmm. in the future, they're going to be more expensive, and it's going to lock these utilities into providing a more expensive source of energy.
Yeah. And I had another question about that, too, because even though there might be a significant capital investment when you're changing over, when you're switching to a renewable energy like wind or solar, but then after that initial investment, I mean, it's not like you're having to extract coal out of the ground over and over and over. It's a one shot, isn't it? I mean,
that's right. And what this bill is addressing is new production. So when a utility mm-hmm. needs to put in a new power plant, and LG&E is likely going to retire their Mill Creek plant, one of their larger coal-burning plants here in the next 5 years, mm-hmm. and they will need to make a decision about what to put in next. And these lawmakers are trying to force them to put coal in mm-hmm. when they can make a significant investment in renewable energy. And as you pointed out, won't require them to have any fuel because they're fueled by sunlight, which is free.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. They'll be cheaper to operate over time. That's mm-hmm. partly how renewables have been able to reach parity with the fossil fuels, because they don't require the fuel.
Mm-hmm. And I might add that it's certainly a significant improvement if we were to go to renewables for our own health. Like, for example, I found out that in 2021, LG&E was fined $750,000 because the Mill Creek station exceeded sulfuric acid emissions. And so they're constantly having to worry about toxic emissions, whether sulfuric acid or I don't know about nitric acid. I know mercury comes from coal-fired power plants, and also significant increases in heart disease we get because of the particulates that get spewed out into the air and then end up in our lungs.
Yes. Studies have shown that approximately 46 people in Louisville die every year prematurely because of pollution from coal-fired power plants. So that's heart disease and lung disease, dying before they should.
Yeah.
We could save those lives with clean energy sources.
Yeah. And your point about regionalism, could you elaborate on that? Talk about the different options that we would have for solar.
Sure. If communities could come together, say at the neighborhood level, and install enough battery capacity and solar panels, each of those communities wouldn't be saddled with having to be tied to the grid on a permanent basis when we have things like these storms. These microgrids could be funded by the individual homeowners. The neighborhood association could sponsor programs that would help develop these, mm-hmm. but it would be decentralized. And you were asking before whether LG&E would be a part of this. It's possible that utilities could do this. They could help bring those about mm-hmm. and still stay in business. I think if they're smart, they'll look into options like that. Otherwise, people will be starting to move away from the fossil fuels if they keep raising their rates and don't give their customers choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one thing about what we have now throughout the country, but also here in Kentucky, is we have monopoly capitalism. with LG&E in the 1990s, Congress deregulated the power industry, and it led to multiple mergers. So that first LG&E acquired KU Energy, Kentucky Utilities, is it? Energy. Then in 2000, PowerGen, which is a British company, acquired LG&E. Then in 2002, a German company, E.ON, acquired PowerGen. And then in 2010, Pennsylvania Power and Light acquired E.ON for $7.6 billion, billion with a B.
That's correct.
And that's millions upon millions of people now we're talking about are under the thumb of one monopoly capitalistic company. Doesn't that give you a little cause for concern? I mean, whether it's, you know, sabotage some foreign agent or just having their customers under their thumb, that we have to just submit to whatever they do.
And residents of Louisville don't have an option either. Other cities around the country provide options. You can select where you want to get your energy from, but Louisville doesn't have that option. Everyone has to use LG&E energy. So if we could make it more democratic, allow people to choose, they could choose to get their electricity from other sources, and that would take some of that power away from those monopolies.
Yeah, right. There must be all kinds of configurations that one could imagine, like in a city like Louisville, like schools, or like you mentioned, neighborhoods, people just getting together. And it wouldn't be controlled anymore by shareholders who live thousands of miles away.
Right. I know a lot of people are simply going off grid. They're getting batteries for their basement and getting solar just to have their family a little more resilient to power outages, whether they're weather related or political. And so I think it's a growing movement. And if the utilities don't do something, they're going to lose a lot of customers.
And is this something that is reliable consistently, or does it depend on lots of sunny days? How reliable is solar? And is that mainly what you're thinking about is solar? Well, you did talk about geothermal and heat pumps, right?
Sure. In Louisville, we're some of the biggest wasters of electricity in the nation. And because historically, we've had a lot of cheap utility rates. And so we all need to be more efficient. My wife and I looked at energy efficiency, and over a five-year period, we were able to reduce our electricity use by 70% by being more efficient.
Wow. And
so if you're going to get solar, you might as well get solar that you're actually going to use, not solar that you're going to waste.
Do you have solar?
Right. We put on solar over a decade ago, and we're still tied to the grid. We didn't get batteries, but that solar provides the electricity we need to run most of our house. We do get solar from other sources to help supplement that. So you can get solar panels and a battery to answer your question. And most of the times that would give you all the electricity you need if you're efficient enough. And so even on cloudy days, you can still get some electricity. At night, you draw from the batteries. But we have plenty of sunshine here in Kentucky. We have as much sunshine as Germany has, and they're the leaders in Europe in solar energy.
Let me ask you about my neighborhood, because I do not have solar panels. And my concern is that I live in a neighborhood that has a lot of old growth trees. And that also is why whenever we have heavy storms, the power goes out because of all the trees.
Right.
So is solar feasible in a neighborhood like mine where there are so many overhanging trees?
Well, sometimes you have to be creative. I know one family that their house was shaded with solar, but they had a sunny backyard. They had a pool and their grandkids would swim. And so they put a pergola out next to the pool and put solar panels on that to provide electricity for their house. And it also provided shade for them to sit while their kids, grandkids are playing in the pool.
Oh, that's neat.
And one of our neighbors, their house was also shaded. Now, one of them wanted a new garage and the other wanted solar panels. So they constructed a garage at the back of the property where it was sunny and put solar panels there. So there are some options.
What about neighbors coming together, and is that a possibility? And then finding a space where they can share the power that's generated from some other neighbors' houses? Is
It's
that?
a possibility. It's hard to find an area, a field or something open enough to power multiple homes here in the city. But it's a possibility. Yes. We lose about 1% of our electricity per mile of those power lines. And so having power generated across the city and transported via line to all the homes is less efficient than if you're producing the energy close to where you're using it.
That's a good point. And so you were saying that for Louisville and for most of Kentucky, solar would be the best way to go, but you don't think wind is a good option?
No, I think wind is wonderful for Kentucky.
Is it?
There's been studies done that show that there are a number of mountaintop removal sites that would be prime for wind turbines. And so we could certainly do that. It wouldn't help you if you're trying to be resilient against the storms, because that's going to produce energy hundreds of miles away and have to transport it here. But we certainly have wind capacity here in Kentucky and more hydro capacity too. There's lots of rivers that we could have turbines in and produce some clean energy.
And so, if somebody listening right now were interested in this, where could they go to find more information?
Well, there are certainly solar installers if you're looking for solar installers. And I would contact either someone you know who's had solar, because not all of the solar contractors are reputable. But if you contact Kentucky Interfaith Power and Light or the Louisville Climate Action Network or some of these other nonprofit organizations, they would be able to give you some names of some reputable installers.
Oh, great. So just Google those names. Repeat them one more time.
Yes, Louisville Climate Action Network or Kentucky Interfaith Power and Light.
Very good. Well, I really appreciate you coming on my show, Tim Darst.
No problem, Ruth. I'm glad I can help.
It's a very hopeful sign that we do have options, and that as the climate continues to worsen, we don't have to just throw up our hands and submit to all of these power outages. We do have choices. So thank you
That's
for
true.
pointing that out. That was a conversation with Tim Darst, who's double master's in environmental education from U of L and sustainability and environmental management from Harvard University, make him eminently qualified to discuss alternative energy options in an era of increasing climate disruption and power outages. And before that was newly elected Kentucky State Senator Cassie Chambers Armstrong talking, among other things, about the rural-urban divide and the many strengths and shared experiences that can potentially bind impoverished communities together. Senator Armstrong will be a featured speaker at our 6th anniversary celebration, to which you are invited on Saturday, April 8th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the CORE, CORE Gallery. That's it for today's Election Connection. This is Ruth Newman saying bye for now.